Welcome to Justice Visions, a podcast about everything that is new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Center of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org.
Welcome to Justice Visions. My name is Tine de Strooper and I'm the regular host of this podcast. And in this season of the podcast, we take a closer look at what certain theoretical concepts mean for the practice of transitional justice and for the daily lives of victims of human rights violations. And today we will talk about a concept that lies at the heart of many transitional justice interventions, which is truth. And we'll explore this notion by taking a broader look at the multiple meanings of the concept of truth. And with us today to talk about this is Angie Kroch, an internationally renowned journalist and writer, but whom I think self-identifies most strongly as a poet. She kindly accepted our invitation to examine the question, how do we talk about truth in South Africa? Welcome, Mrs. Kroch.
Thank you.
And I believe that most of our listeners are probably, at least to some extent, familiar with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa that was established in 1995, as well as with the horrendous crimes that it was dealing with. So I propose that we're not going to talk about that too much to start. And what I want to ask you instead is if you could say a bit more about your role, because as a reporter for the South African Broadcasting Corporation, you covered the proceedings and the hearings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And when I read your writing, it's quite clear that this commission also profoundly impacted you personally. And I was wondering if you could say a bit more about why it is that this commission had such an impact on you personally.
I think it would be arrogant and false of myself to suggest that either I personally was affected or that I played a role, because it was such a huge South African operation. I had a team of journalists that reported from different languages. So we were a team of between 8 and 12, sometimes 15 people. We had two people who just fed the news bulletins of radio. We had another group who just did Q&As about what is happening. We had another group who did small packages. And then we had another team who was broadcasting 24 hours the hearings. So it was a vast operational setup only for radio. And all of us were affected. Also the truth commissioners themselves, after a week, some of them couldn't walk, some of them had bodily pains, some fell. The briefers and the psychologists who debriefed people were ill. And then I noticed that in my own team, people were falling apart. So it was it's not easy, not only to listen to victims, but it's very difficult to feel this desire to do it well, to do justice to what you hear. You see the pain and you experience the sacrifice that was behind this story or these words, and you want to do justice. So people worked extraordinary hours. We supported one another, and also across journalistic genres, the TV journalists, the newspaper journalists, we were like, you know, this one will bring coffee, that one will comfort that one who is crying, this one. So, yeah, it was an unexpected trauma for all, I would say.
You're talking about different genres, and what I find interesting is that indeed you were not only radio reporting about the commission, but then you also wrote about the commission and you also wrote poetry about the commission. And maybe also as a start to this conversation, I wanted to ask you if you would be so kind as to read one of the poems that deals with this topic of the Truth Commission.
I will read a litany that deals with whiteness as the perpetrator. Here along the long white shadow, where I thought I'd leave the litany of locust and death, I'll always hear the litany of sound. Here along the long white shadow, where I grab luster, grab honor that once was luster and white, the truth I've heard and how to molest it. That I travel along the corn or chaff of my past, that my past crawls forth on its deadly knees without once looking up, that I claw on my knees, claw to that place, that light place that does not want to dim. Here along the long white shadow of mortal and molested truth, we buried without shroud or ritual. Many we buried, and from the graves it sprouts, the shadow sprouts of luster, burdock and weed, the locusts of sound here along the long white shadow, and my past sits so well in its teeth, all along its teeth sit well in the shadow of sulphur and lime. It's time, the time of assassin and shame and tin. I keep slipping out of truth, while next to me along the long white shadow walks the shudder that I was, walks the long white shudder of ash. Set me, I who keep slipping in the long white shadow, out of time, out of random and lies, I want slipping from the shudder along the emptiness of litany and shadow. Set me from revenge and loss, from ruin. Set me from the long white scar, the lesion and ash. Set me free into remorse. Oh, my hand grabs the sheet like a throat.
Thank you so much for sharing this, and also for illustrating so wonderfully how you turn to poetry to, I think, do what you just mentioned, to do justice to this experience. And I think you don't only turn to poetry in your work, but you also use fiction to relate this experience, these facts. And I wanted to ask you a question about that, because in the book The Country of My Skull, I think in the afterword you write, I have told many lies in this book about the truth. And so in the book, what you do is, in a way, you interweave these fictional and factual elements, and you say that you keep the testimony of the victims and keep that intact, but that you also deliberately fictionalize certain events and certain characters. And I wanted to ask you about your decision to proceed in that way, to combine facts and fiction in this work.
You know, when the book was written and published, it was a big discussion. Should it be marketed as fiction or as non-fiction? And then it was said, yeah, but maybe it's literary non-fiction. Nowadays, that debate is old and stale, because suddenly everyone is busy with autobiographical fiction, literary autobiography. So the genres have become so mixed, and the discussion on South African literature by someone like Leon de Kock has then rated A Country of My Skull as actually a door that was pushed open, after which several books followed the same kind of pattern, or not pattern, but style. And that in the end, it's quite silly to think, yes, I use fiction. Yes, you have characters. Yes, I have catharsis. Yes, I tell a story. It cannot be a report, because the reports exist. I have reported. My own reports exist as reports. So there's no use in redoing that. But doing the book, I felt it would be immensely selfish to just have the victim's stories and I, as a white perpetrator, just stand back because it's my people who have done that and pretend I'm not involved, pretend that I'm not there. I'm just telling this story, or I'm just giving the story that was in public domain. It felt to me dishonest, and the difference between reporting and writing a book like that is that you, with the reporting, is what was being said. I'm not interested in your opinion. Although your opinion is, of course, always there in your choice, what you give, what you present, how you present it. So basically, there isn't such a thing as neutrality. It's a fantasy. So I wouldn't even say that I've included fiction in that book, because it was fictional elements. There was also a lot of literary and also academic work that I studied about trauma, about telling, about perpetrating, about that. I had interviews with psychologists, with political analysts, with academics. And all of that is manifesting in the book, but a word here and a sentence there. Nowadays, you would have to get clearance from everyone. May I use that word? May I use that sentence? Thank God it wasn't there that time. But in a way, you also need to be truly honest also about the perpetrators. You need some protection when they were analyzed cruelly. Anyway, so I would disagree now and say, yeah, there's not really fictional elements. It's just a better way than reporting.
Is then your choice to proceed in this specific way? When you say you were talking about also talking to people about trauma, etc., is the choice to proceed in this way in the book also inspired by this idea that by proceeding in this specific way, you can create something which is truer than truth, in a sense that trauma can never be known and can never be completely understood if we only report the facts, because it's so vastly different and so outside of our realm of the imaginable? Do you feel that the genre that you adopted by introducing certain characters or fictional elements, if you will, or narratives, that it allowed us that as a reader to have a better access to the truth?
I would say so, because, for example, the academic literature that you read, or let me take a step back, there's a lot of writing now suddenly about real life everywhere. And we have several workshops and there's conferences where people bring their work. And then it's very interesting work. And the moment they move on to academic theory, it dies. It dies just there. Because the language is different. It's not personal. It's not attached. It's just there. And so it kills the theory and it kills the very good story. Some of the arguments that I have is arguments that are busy in theory. But you make these arguments, say, between me and my husband, so that you immediately tone the language down to an ordinary language. You connect it to what you are talking about. And so you make the theory, or you not make the theory, you use the theory to explore the depth of what you have just heard. The story of the shepherd. You could just report on it and you could. But if you really truly want to understand it, you have to bring in all the unbelievable elements that are there. So I would say it depends on the motive, perhaps.
That's interesting, because what you're saying also reminds me of also one of the achievement of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was precisely that they distinguished between these four kinds of truth, with forensic and factual truth being a first one, and then social and dialogical truth, healing, truth. Restorative truth, and narrative truth. Is what you're saying also related to that, to these various ways of understanding truth? Do we need these various understandings of truth? And I would also add, are they important to victims as well, to distinguish between these various kinds of
crucial.
Truth?
It's crucial. It's not only for victims, it's also for perpetrators. I say in the book somewhere, some of the journalists say, "Hi, Anki, but that didn't happen like that." And I say, for me, so there is validity. I mean, as the two of us sit here, you will hear another interview than I am hearing. And yours is not invalid, or mine is not invalid. So there has to be space. Even if you lie, and I think that's extremely important. I've learned this with the writing of abuse, that people write about themselves being abused, and then someone says, it didn't happen. It actually doesn't matter whether it happened. If they're in a court case, that's something else. But if that person feels in a way violated, then it did happen. It did happen. And even the perpetrators, the fact that they felt safe to do it, the fact that they felt heroes doing or received orders, I think is an important contribution to context.
I would want to ask you what you feel about the argument that the fact that telling happened at all at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is more important than what was being told there.
Yeah, by far. It was a tsunami of truths thrown, washing over the country. And none of us has ever been the same after that. They say technically, theoretically, they say the amount of lies have been lessened and all. It's not that. It is that. Is that you know some things went terribly wrong. And that we'd like to forget that. Even now, we would like to pretend that our country is going down the drain, not because anything we did in the past as white people, but because black people cannot really, run a sophisticated government, which is not true. You have not only colonialism and apartheid for 300 years, but you have a continent of slavery, where slaves were torn from. Yeah, and that is the haunting horror of Africa, is to try and find your feet, find stability, deliver genius, giftedness, remarkable leaders, etc., while you have been so thoroughly attacked in a way by Europe, especially. Yeah.
You speak of this tsunami of truths and of no one really being the same anymore after that. When I read you, I also feel that there's a skepsis in terms of the potential of healing of such a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Am I correct that you're skeptical about the commission's potential for healing?
I'm not skeptical because I've seen it happen. But what I am more, can I say, irritated with is when people suggest that the job of the Truth Commission was to bring out truth and reconciliation. And it wasn't its job. It started as the door to a democracy. So in a period of transitional justice, an interim constitution was written in which you could protect the police, the civil service, the army, and promise them there will be a structure after in democracy that will not hang them, chase them, so that they can, because they were white. Yeah? They were all part of the old guard. And they had to protect this frail day of election. And if they knew that they were going to jail, I said, they wouldn't. They would undermine it and blast it up. So the job of the Truth Commission was to give that strategy, to give the perpetrators a process through which they could apply for amnesty. Now when you look back, you can see they hardly give any, I think they received over 9,000 amnesty applications, of which they have given not even 1,000. And Thabo Mbeki, our second president, said, you left us in a mess. We wanted you to get rid of all these former perpetrators by giving them amnesty so that we can continue. And you didn't. So it was very difficult to get amnesty. So the fact that some truths also came out, the fact that forgiveness happened, that was actually the unexpected.
That's interesting, because it makes me wonder what it does now that we are increasingly institutionalizing, in a way, that link between truth and reconciliation. Because from what you're saying, indeed, you're calling it an unexpected outcome, but I think increasingly within the transitional justice architecture, we're assuming that truth necessarily leads to reconciliation. And I guess you would find that problematic then, that almost cementing that in those two notions.
Yeah, my problem with, you know, with most of the other truth commissions and commissions is that it's a one-sided affair. You either have only the victims, you never have a perpetrator story, or it's behind closed doors, you just have a report. As if truth is only for victims, you know, that's all you're interested in. Let them tell their sad stories, you know, we won't listen, but let them tell it and they will feel better afterwards. And you know, and the real perpetrators and things we will have behind closed doors, or mostly they give them blanket amnesty. So I don't necessarily see, there's not a natural connection, but I did see it happen. That, and it's not necessarily the truth that brought the reconciliation, but the truthfulness of the looking each other in the face.
Would literature and arts also have played a role in this, would you argue? Because there's the Truth Commission on the one hand, but then you've also spoken about how a lot of actors actually took up the testimonies that were given at the Truth Commission and in one way or another tried to do justice to them. Has this also played a role in facilitating unexpected or planned reconciliation and healing?
The amount of material, literary material, that came out of South Africa, as well as documentary material, is slim. All the documentaries came from overseas. Even the Japanese made a documentary. The Russians, the Israelis, the Irish. There's several wonderful documentaries on the perpetrators by the Dutch. We didn't make, and there's that famous one that came from New York on the Amy Beale killings. I think South Africans were so washed out after the commission, and I never wrote a poem about it, about the happening, or I've taken a testimony and decided I'm going to do a poem on this, because it is impossible. You can't get it right. And what do you want with it? Must there be beauty? It is formed part of books and some plays. Now, after a long time, there was a very, very good film called Forgiveness, about a perpetrator going back to a family of color to say sorry. And I think that's about the only text that I've seen that has a lot of nuance, and not just the perpetrator is a monster and the victims are the angels and that is the end of the story, which is often the favorite meme.
Our last question about the Truth Commission itself. I would be interested in hearing your opinion about whether you feel that this commission has been a success. And I know, of course, that that implies questions about whose parameters are we using and who is this a success for. But I think it's an important question because we see truth commissions becoming increasingly popular, not just in post-apartheid, post-conflict, post-authoritarian states, but also in consolidated democracies. And so on the one hand, we see this boom in truth commissions, and on the other hand, we see a lot of critical literature about what a truth commission can and cannot do. Also, a lot of critical literature about what the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission has done. And I'm interested in hearing your assessment about whether or not this was a successful commission and whether that's sufficiently acknowledged also, if so.
I'm not the right person to ask about that. I know it said it has failed. There's a lot of criticism against the commission, and it has many failings. The one is the amnesty, the other one is the reparation. But I can't imagine the country without it. Even those who cut themselves off from what is happening there, it has reached them in a way, and it is because of the stories of the victims, together with the stories of the perpetrators. I think it's important to have both. And I do not think literature can do the work that a truth commission can do. Literature can work afterwards. Literature should work before. Because I was asking myself, I was well read in all South African literature. Before the Truth Commission, I read newspapers. I know things were happening. But I hadn't imagined the depth, the width of the depravity. I felt left in the lurch by literature. Why? I mean, you know that individuals were bad. You know, but that there was at that scale, no. I still can't point to any book written before literature that indicated that, unless it's symbolically, you know, that all people are evil or that the evil is anyway everywhere and so on, but not the meticulous torture and killing and destruction of people beyond the ordinary apartheid, if I may say so.
If I may, I would like to ask you a very last question that we ask to all our interviewees on this show, which is about where you find inspiration and where you see hope, and then especially if we're talking about this issue of truth telling, truth hearing, truth listening, truth seeking. Do you see some initiatives, some tendencies or dynamics that make you hopeful in terms of how we can do this right, how we can do this better?
I thought the whole night about that. And I'm afraid I see nowhere. It is as if Truth Commissions has become a kind of commodity. You just have to have it, you know. It doesn't need to do anything, but you just need to have it to say you've had it. I don't see the justice. I don't see, and even also in South Africa, the justice is not there. And then I have to say this terrible thing, that the last big restorative process was done by the Germans, with the money they've given to Israel, with the pensions they paid, at least. I know, the Jews would say, but how can you ever restore that? How can you ever make up? How can you ever give justice? It is true. You can never. But that gives most countries and most people a blanket check. not blanket check. You don't need to do anything because you cannot do anything that help. So don't do anything. At least there was an attempt. It was thought through and it was exercised. And I remember Finkelstein, a writer, telling an audience in Bali and Amsterdam that the only security in his life as a child of two parents that survived Auschwitz was the monthly check from the German government. Yeah, I wish I can say the same to South African victims, that that is at least their security. So where's the justice? No, I'm sorry, I don't see it.
And instead, I think of ending on a hopeful note. We'll end on a cautionary note for those countries now installing truth commissions, making sure that they are not just empty boxes and not just labels. And then I'm just going to thank you so much, nevertheless. Even if you haven't given us a hopeful or happy note to end on, thank you so much for this conversation, for sharing your insights, for reading the poem. And for our listeners, we will also make sure to post the poem in our show notes so that you can go back to it. Thank you so much.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council.